Leaders are all around us, at all times and in every area of our lives. They motivate, they risk the first step. But what motivates a leader? In KWBU Central Texas Leadership Series, we talk with people in our community who guide and inspire to find out what makes them tick. In this episode, Cheryl Victorian, Chief of the Waco Police Department, discusses her start in police work, the guidance she had along her journey to becoming Waco's first woman and African-American police chief, and her deep commitment to relational policing and building bridges in the communities she serves. Hosting today's conversation is KWBU's Community Engagement Coordinator, Rachel Velasco. This conversation was recorded January 23rd in the KWBU studio.
Chief Victorian, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, I just want to start off by saying that, you know, having you as the chief of police, and I mentioned this just a minute ago, it feels like there wasn't a time before Chief Victorian in our city. You've done so much since you've been here, and you've made such a great impact. I would love to just hear kind of how you got started. Like, what got you into police work from the beginning? So take us back to the very beginning and tell us a little bit about how you got your start, where you're from, all that good stuff.
Wow, let's go way back.
Let's go way back.
So I am originally from Houston, Texas. I grew up in a neighborhood called Sunnyside that's in southeast Houston. And I will tell you that policing has not always been my career choice. In fact, I was afraid of police officers growing up. I tell this story all the time. My mom would take me to a local grocery store and just to get me to shake the hand of a constable that was there, and I would fall out. I was 4 or 5 years old, and I would fall out crying, scared. And I don't remember if anyone ever told me maybe the police are going to put me in jail or something, but I was afraid of police officers, right? And then it didn't help that I had this mischievous neighbor who told me that the Houston Police Department's helicopter landed on our street, and they were looking for me. So my mom lived in the flight path of the Houston Police helicopter, right? And this was back in the 1900s and 70s. It was a long time ago. But he said that the helicopter landed and asked for Cheryl. And I was like, oh my God, that's me. And then he was like, and they asked if she was a Taurus. And I was like, I'm a Taurus, right? Now, I didn't know the cops didn't ask for your sign at the time, but you know, who knows? So for about 2 years, man, every time we heard those blades on those helicopters, if we were outside playing, my friends and I would run behind trees, bushes, cars, you name it, because I thought they were looking for me, right? I hadn't done anything wrong, I don't think. And then at 9, I lost my dad. He had a massive heart attack and passed away. And I remember the police officers, the motorcycle guys that were escorting us out of town as we left the funeral home. They were very compassionate. They were empathetic. And then I kind of focused on them as we were heading out of town. And back in those days, people used to pull over on the side of the freeway when they saw, you know, a funeral coming. And I saw all of that. And I was like, man, these guys are great, right? And then a few years later, in the 1980s, these shows came out. One was Miami Vice, and the other was Beverly Hills Cops. And I was like, you know what? I want to work undercover. This is what I want to do, be a police officer. And it has just been a passion of mine for a long time. I got off track a couple of times thinking I wanted to go to law school. And then at one time I thought I was going to be a probation officer, and somebody got me back on track and finished college, went straight into the police academy, and the rest was history. I started with the Houston Police Department back in 1993 as a rookie police officer, worked the streets after I got off the training program, worked the gang task force, got a magic call to come and do some undercover work on some overtime, and didn't know this guy from Adam when he called, and I was like, yeah, I'll do undercover work. I had no idea what I would be doing. I just knew I was going to be Beverly Hills Cops and Miami Vice, and did that for 11 and a half years, and it was one of my favorite times as an officer. All of a sudden, my suspects started getting a little younger. The lingo changed. I wasn't having fun anymore. I decided to transfer. Went to homicide and worked homicide for about 5.5 months and promoted out of homicide to sergeant. I promoted to my first rank at 14 years in the department, which is really kind of long in policing. But I'm so glad that God's timing is not my timing, because I learned so much as an officer and spending that much time as an officer. I worked for 7 years as a sergeant, went back to the streets, worked investigative first responders where I had a chance to develop other police officers to go into investigations, worked in child sexual abuse, and then I got a call, an involuntary call, to go to internal affairs. And I worked internal affairs for about 3.5 years. And during that time, decided that I wanted to promote to lieutenant, took the lieutenant's exam, promoted to lieutenant, went back to child sexual abuse for a year. Then I went to the training academy for a year and took the commander's exam, promoted to commander, and went back to the streets and worked South Central Patrol, which is the area outside of downtown Houston. And after being a commander for 11 months, I got a call from who was Chief Acevedo at the time, offering me an assistant chief's job. And so for 3.5 years, I worked as an assistant chief with the Houston Police Department until I got that wonderful call about this position, and thought it over, prayed about it, and decided to apply. And January, I think it was 29th, I was offered the job and have been here since March the 5th, 2021, and I'm still having the time of my life.
Wow. I mean, first of all, the fact that you could encapsulate that much experience in such a short, like, kudos to you. That was amazing.
Thank you.
But to hear the depth of your experience and all of the different ways that you've been incorporated within that sort of police ecosystem, I think it's incredible to hear that, you know, you were able to transition to so many different things. Did you have a favorite? Like, was undercover your favorite time?
Yeah, working undercover as an undercover officer for 11 and a half years had to be my favorite time as an officer. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And like I said, when I stopped having fun is when I decided I need to go and learn something else and do something different. And that's what I love about policing, especially if you're an agency the size of Houston. You have options. You can quit a job without really quitting a job, right? You can go and transfer and do something else and develop those skills and develop a career path for yourself and try to stick to it as best you can. And that's what I did.
I think that hearing you talk about, you know, transferring and getting and then promoting up these different ranks and getting all this experience, do you feel like having such a broad sort of experience level in all these different departments and all these different types of police work that you did that, was that an advantage going into some of these promotions, do you think?
Absolutely. Because when we go through a promotional process, when we're with the Houston Police Department, and the same thing in Waco, we have to take a test. And then we have to go through an assessment center. I am not a very good test taker, right? And people would make 99s and 100s on an exam, and I was happy with my little 82s and 86s, right? But I knew I had to make up ground in the assessment center. And that assessment center is when they put you in scenario-based situations, and you get to apply the scenarios that they give you, and that's where that experience came in. And that's where I always excelled and would always push me up on that list above some of those that made 99s and 100s on the actual exam. So, yeah, that experience went a very long way with every examination and every assessment center process.
That's such an encouraging thing to hear you say, because I know I was an educator for a long time, and I had lots of kids who were just so good at certain things, but they really struggled with test taking. And to hear that there are opportunities for those folks, you know, hey, maybe you're not the best test taker in the world, but you have the skills, you have the experience, that those things really do go a long way in creating sort of a whole experience. And so thank you for mentioning that, because I think that's a great encouragement for folks out there listening who are like, hey, I could be, you know, I could be whatever I want to be too.
That's right. You sure can.
Did you have any particular mentors or folks along the way that really encouraged you or like spoke into you to kind of help encourage you along or give you advice? Or, you know, can you talk a little bit about what that looked like, having other people around you?
Yeah, sure. So in policing right now, we make up less than 13% of females in this profession. And there are more than 18,000 police agencies across this country. And we're talking about police chiefs. We make up less than 3% of those 18,000 police agencies. One of the fortunate things for me as I was coming up through the Houston Police Department is that we did have a few females in leadership positions. So I was able to see, you know, that we could aspire to get to those levels, right? So I had role models, essentially, but I really didn't have a mentor until I became an assistant chief. I had people that deposited in me along the way. For example, Internal Affairs Division, nobody wants to go to Internal Affairs, right? And like I said earlier, it is an involuntary assignment. And so I was working in child sexual abuse. You know, I didn't think I would like that assignment. Ended up loving it, had the best investigators working with me and for me, and I got very comfortable. and we should not be comfortable. But I didn't know that at the time. I had to grow and mature and learn that, right? And so I got this phone call one day telling me that I needed to come sign my paperwork because I was reporting to Internal Affairs on February the 5th. And this was like the first or second week in January. We had just come back from the holidays. And I was like, sir? And he repeated it matter of fact and was like, you need to get here to sign your paperwork. You're going to Internal Affairs. And so I was like, yes, sir. And I hung up the phone and I was like, oh my God, I got to go to ID. So I went around the corner to my lieutenant's office, who was a female. And I was like, Lieutenant, I said, I just got a call from IED. They told me to come sign paperwork. And she was like, oh, no, ma'am, we need you here in the position that you're in. I'm going to write a letter to the chief. But in the meantime, I need you to go sign this paperwork so we're not in support. Yes, ma'am, of course. So I go and sign my paperwork in the back of my head thinking, you know what, chief, my lieutenant's going to write me a letter. I'm not going to have to go. Well, a few days later, came back and said, no, she has to go. And so one day in the parking lot, this gentleman stopped me. I didn't know who he was. He was a sergeant, and I was a sergeant, but he had a little bit more time than me. And he was like, hey, I understand you're trying to get out of IED. And I'm like, well, he was like, listen, he said, this is a position that will allow you to help officers who have done the right thing to keep their job or conduct a thorough enough investigation for those who have tarnished the badge to get them out of here. He said, go in with an open mind. It's not going to be as bad as you think. He said, you have the opportunity to go far in this organization. He said, and you need to see the good, the bad, and the ugly. And so from that point forward, I felt like, well, okay, somebody's talking about me. I didn't know, you know, this gentleman personally, and went in with an open mind, and that's exactly what happened. And, it was an experience that I thoroughly enjoyed and realized that I needed to be there. And it has been so helpful in me in my role as when I promoted to lieutenant, when I promoted to commander, assistant chief, and now as chief. It was just a path that I was supposed to be on. So
that's amazing. As I'm hearing you talk about this, I mean, I've got like 1,000 questions because it's so fascinating to hear about what it looks like kind of behind the curtain, you know, just as a citizen of the community.
Right.
But I do want, you know, I know you mentioned having females in leadership ahead of you and getting to see that. I would like to kind of pivot a little bit to now, like your role here in Waco. I mean, you're taking on some firsts in your role, you know, the first female chief, first African-American chief. What has that experience been like as you're kind of being a bit of a trailblazer, to be honest here? Can you talk a little bit about what that's been?
It's really been exceptional. It's been truly exceptional. The experiences that I have with the community, being embraced by our community, being willing and invited to come out and tell my story, right, to be an inspiration to women, to empower women, has just simply been incredible. I didn't apply for the job to become the first female. I didn't apply for the job to become the first African-American. But it just so happened that way, right? And so now it is my goal to just inspire other females, other African Americans, and anybody really, that if I can take this journey and be in this position, so can you. You can do it too. So, yeah.
I heard you just say like being embraced by the community, and I have to just reiterate that again. I mean, I think there was such an excitement when you were announced as the new police chief across the city. It was like this breath of fresh air that came in. That, you know, we've had great leadership in our city for a long time, but getting you come with such a wonderful perspective, and I want to talk a little bit about that now, which is this idea of really leaning hard into relational policing and building bridges with the community. And I think that your work has been, you can see it all around. If you're paying attention to what the police department's doing, you can see all of the initiatives that y'all have been taking to really strengthen those ties. How did you kind of develop these principles? How did you kind of land on this is the way you wanted to lead? I'd love to hear you talk about that.
Oh my God, let's talk about that. So when I was appointed to assistant chief, before I was appointed to assistant chief, I was a commander. We got Chief Art Acevedo come to Houston as the new chief from Austin. And when he came, he started talking about these principles of being transparent, respectful, engaging, and building emotional capital and accountability, right, to build trust. And he would talk about it frequently. And then he termed it relational policing. And I was just so fascinated by it, of being a lifelong learner going, I was like, man, these are some simple principles that can impact not just our lives professionally, but our lives personally when we're trying to build trust. What simple tenets, right? So I went to him one day and I was like, Chief, you mind if I brand relational policing for the department and let's put some stuff on the walls and, you know, get some images out there? And he was like, absolutely not. Please do, right? And I did. And just before I left, I got with this gentleman who was very good at graphics at Houston PD. And he started putting some things together and we started making posters and stuff. And then I left. And when I left, I said, Chief, I am taking relational policing with me. And he was like, by all means. He was like, it's not mine to hold on to. Everybody needs to be practicing relational policing. And then I was asked by the Law Enforcement Management Institute of Texas, which is a training facility for executives here in Texas, if I would like to come and teach in some of their programs. And I was like, absolutely. And they're like, well, what are you good at? And I was like, relational policing. Let's do really. And so I've in turn coined this other phrase, relational leadership, because I think it's so important that these very same tenets that we're using to try to build trust and connect with the community, we need to do it inside of our organizations. And I think that, you know, being transparent, respectful, engaging, building emotional capital and accountability inside of our organization, when we do it inside, it's just a demonstration to our teams of what we expect them to do outside of our organization. So, yeah, we've fully embraced relational policing now.
Well, and it bleeds out. I mean, you can see the impact that it's having, you know, among the community. Right. And so I'd like to ask you, you know, what are some initiatives that the Waco PD has put in place to really kind of strengthen and show that? I mean, we've seen some of them, but I'd love to hear from your perspective, like, are there specific programs or specific instances that you guys are really leaning into this to kind of build these relationships?
Yeah, absolutely. So there were already some programs in place before I got here. Like you said, I came into a good police department. I was just hoping that once I got here, I could make it even better, right? So we had programs like the Explorers, Junior Police Academy, Citizens Police Academy, right? But now we have a fundamental vision of how we want to connect and build those relationships, right? So when I came, I brought Trunk or Treat, right? So we started doing Trunk or Treat. And the idea was for us to be able to do stuff at the police tower. We're right there in the center of the neighborhood. And we wanted to invite people into our home, because what better way to connect with somebody than inviting them to your home, right? Well, we outgrew it after the first year. And so we started partnering with other members of the community. Right now, we have a strong partnership with WISD. So we had to take it to the grounds of the stadium, right, to actually do Trunk or Treat. And what's so amazing about the Trunk or Treat event is that we have so many people that volunteer from different neighborhood organizations, different businesses, different city departments that will come out, decorate their vehicles, bring their own candy, I mean, out of their own pocket, just to help us build those relationships and build those gaps in the community. And it's just been so incredible. So we also do Back to School Bash, right? Because the one thing that we want our children to know is that we are not looking to put them in jail. We are their friends. We want to see them succeed. However, if you make bad choices, yeah, eventually you will see us. But we want to position you to succeed so we don't have to see you, right? And what better way for a police department to connect with our kids than by making sure that they have what they need to start school, right? And then from there, it just kind of grew. Now my team feels so empowered to come up with their own initiatives, and they know that typically they're going to get a yes from me. Let's try it. If it doesn't work, we'll do something else, right? And that's how we came up with the community opportunity event, right? At one point, we saw an increase in 2022 of violent crime. It was like, what do we need to do? How do we need to address it? And then it was, let's not give people an excuse. Let's give them an opportunity to get the education. They say they can be hired. There are people here that will hire just as involved individuals. So now it has grown to over 100 vendors. But the idea originated with Officer or Detective Eric Hawkins. And he came to me with an idea and I said, let's do it. And it has been so successful the past couple of years. And we're looking forward. Right now, we're planning for the community opportunity event this year. I mean, they're coming up with some fantastic ideas. And we just had a Christmas event that another one of our neighborhood engagement officers came up with that, you know, it's just, I'm just so proud of them. I'm like, okay, I'm stepping back. And people are going, Chief, you're doing such a great job. I was like, that's my team. My team is, they're taking lead now and they're doing great things. I'm so proud of them.
I love that you are empowering the people that work with you at the department to make those suggestions and decisions, and then you're supporting them as they go out to build those relationships. And I think that really stems from a sense of strong leadership. They know that they trust in you, and that you have their back, and that you're all sort of rowing in the same direction because you all have the same goals in mind. When you're teaching these principles and talking about, you know, what leadership looks like in this sort of relational, like you were talking about, you're building this at the top, and then it's coming down in and infiltrating the organization. What are some things that you would say to, you know, just any folks that are listening to us right now that maybe they have a business or they're on a board or an organization that they have a leadership role? What are some strategies that they might be able to use to start to bring these sort of ideas into practice?
I would say to adopt the tenets of relational policing. Again, very, very simple tenets that spell out the word TREAT, T-R-E-E-A-T, right? Transparency, respect, engagement, emotional capital, accountability, and all of that builds trust, right? And particularly, I think what's most important of those tenets is that respect one. Right. We want to treat people the way we want to be treated, and we want to treat them the way they want to be treated. Right. And it's so important to me because we all have to hold somebody accountable. I think I can speak for most leaders when they say one of the most difficult decisions we have to make is holding somebody accountable or terminating somebody. And so when somebody is sitting across from us and we're giving them corrective action or trying to correct their behavior or having to make a decision to terminate them, there's still a level of dignity and respect that that person should be able to maintain when they walk out of your office. If you're a good leader, when you tell somebody that they have disappointed you, sometimes that's worse than whatever the corrective action is going to be, right? And so I think it's so important that we are building those relationships inside of our department and or inside of our agencies, wherever it is, whatever industry that you're in, by being respectful. Transparency, engaging, all of that is still very, very important, and building that emotional capital. So when you have to ask them to do those hard tasks, that they do it because you've built that emotional capital. Yeah, respect and dignity are the ones that are the core components for me to build that relationship.
That's great advice. I mean, we can always, respect makes everything that's difficult just a little bit easier.
Yeah,
and when you can build and show that respect among people, I think that that's just good life advice.
Right.
You know, no matter where you are in your journey of life, finding a way to be respectful to those around you is great. I mean, you heard it from Chief Victorian right here, y'all. Be respectful.
Yes.
I think that's gorgeous. You know, we're here, we're just getting into 2025, right? So we've got this whole big year ahead of us. What's new and exciting coming up for you in this new year?
So we have several new projects and programs that we have going on. One that just started, it started last year, and we're looking to grow it now with our partner with the Behavioral Health Network. We're always looking for opportunities to collaborate, right, and perform police services differently. For very long, leaders in the police profession have looked at so many issues in our cities, and we're going, that's not our issue, that's somebody else's problem. Well, it continues to fall in our lap. So we have to figure it out. If you can't beat them, you got to join them. So I have decided that I'm no longer complaining about them. I'm going, okay, what is our role and how can we fix it? How can I minimize opportunities for my officers coming in contact with somebody with mental health issues or somebody who is unhoused? What is it that we can do? So we have formed a partnership with Behavioral Health Network, and we have a crisis call diversion center that's inside of our dispatch. And those calls that come in and we know that they are mental health related, we send them to the professionals because that's not our, you know, we receive crisis intervention training, right? But we don't have the skills, a skill level or the skill set of those who studied it and are professional, right? So we hand those calls over to them. Unless there's a factor where that individual is trying to hurt themselves or somebody else, we're trying not to get involved, right? And so I think that seeing that partnership continue to grow, it started as a little pilot. We understand that it is about to grow with our partners at the Behavioral Health Network. So we're really excited about that. We also, one of my assistant chiefs and I, Chief Jared Wallace, are part of this program called New Blue. and we had to come up with a project. New Blue is a national organization, and they try to identify ways to help support police departments connect better with their communities and just do things different, just police different. And I can't tell you that I have always been that police officer. I used to be a police officer that everybody had to go to jail, right? But it took some growth and maturity and realizing I couldn't arrest my way out of everything, that prevention and intervention became just as important as apprehension. Don't get me wrong, some people still are going to have to go to jail because they're not going to get it right. But with this program with New Blue, we wanted to promote understanding of those new police officers that are coming in to our city. So we have this program that we're starting, and right now the name is Project Connect. It may change, who knows, but where we're going to totally merge our new recruits into our communities before they're actually hitting the streets, so they can learn some history about Waco, so they can learn about some Waco Police Department history and community history, and understand the communities that they're going into. So we'll have community members actually have conversations with our new recruits, and maybe we sit down and have lunch with them and get them to talk about any of the reservations or issues that may have happened, and how we've rebuilt those, or how we can rebuild those relationships.
That sounds like so much growth that's, yeah, you know, kind of on the horizon. I think there's a lot of reason to be excited about what the police department's doing. Sweet. We only have a little bit of time left, but I would be sad if we didn't get to talk just a tiny bit about your book,
okay,
The Me I See.
Yes.
So, you know, in just this last little bit of time, tell us, how did you get started with writing that, and kind of what was your heart behind it?
Okay, so the heart behind The Me I See, right? I love going into schools and connecting with the kids, right? And it only takes 15 to 20 minutes and you have friends forever. Well, on two different occasions, I went to schools, and I had one young lady tell me at one school that she didn't know girls could be the police. And then I went to another school months later and had a little girl say she didn't know girls could be police chiefs. And I was like, okay, you know, there's a remedy for that. Right. Yes, you can. Right. And then there's an organization called 30 by 30, and the 30 by 30 initiative. Our goal is to try to get 30% female representation in police recruiting classes by the year 2030. So they were a big inspiration to me as well. So I got on it. But in the course of writing that book, to let young ladies know that they too make good police officers, I thought it was important to identify those characteristics that we are trying to promote in policing and get young people attached really early and help them to stay focused to become police officers, because the qualities that we're looking for, it's already in them. And I think the book kind of tells that story.
Oh my goodness. That's thank you for sharing that. And like, I could probably spend, I don't know, the next, you know, year talking to you about all of the things you have going on, all of your experiences. Yeah. You know, I do just want to like kind of wrap things up by saying, we at the station are very grateful for your time, and we know you're very busy, and the fact that you were willing to come in and share your story and talk about all of the great things that are happening at Waco PD. You know, we can't thank you enough for coming out today.
No, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure just serving here in this role. So thank you.
And if anyone has questions about anything that's happening at the police department or with your book, is there a good way for them to either get a hold of you or find out more information about anything we've talked about today?
Yeah, you can go to our website, on the city's website, the Waco Police Department, and has all our programs. You can even contact me via the web. And if you're interested in purchasing the book, it's on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Well, once again, Chief Victorian, it's been such a delight. Thank you so much for being here today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
You can find this and previous episodes of Central Texas Leadership Series alongside other local productions from KWBU by heading to the programs page at kwbu.org.